This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to be talking about integrating employees, bringing them in to the workforce, employees who have disabilities and medical conditions into the employment area. My guests are employment law attorneys Jane Cowell and Gene Hyams. I'll tell you a little bit about them in just a minute because it's very important. Both their backgrounds are very extensive. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Now, let me tell you a little bit about my guests. Gene Hyams is a partner and trial lawyer in the Oakland law firm of Levy, Vinnick, Burl, Hyams, where she represents employees in discrimination, harassment, retaliation, and whistleblower lawsuits. For the past 3 years, she's been named one of the top 100 lawyers, 100 attorneys, I guess. It's the same thing to me, in Northern California on the annual Super Lawyers list published by Thomson Reuters. In addition to litigating cases on behalf of employees, Ms. Hyams serves as a court-appointed and private mediator of employment disputes. My other guest is Jane Cowell, who's the founder of HR Law Consultants, a San Francisco-based employment law firm that specializes in advising and training companies on how to comply with a range of workplace laws, including their obligation to provide reasonable accommodations and leaves of absences for employees with disabilities and medical conditions. Jane Cowell has defended employers in lawsuits and trained hundreds of managers and human resources professionals throughout California on how to engage in the interactive process, and we'll tell you what that means. Frankly, it's a new term to me. When determining what form of accommodations would be reasonable and effective to enable the employee to perform his or her essential job functions. So I welcome you, Jane, and you, Gene, to the program. And here's the first question. We're talking about disabilities, and the big term is reasonable accommodation in the workplace. Why is that so significant?
Why is disabilities in a workplace significant?
Yes, and reasonable accommodation.
Okay. Well. First of all, thanks for having us both here, Chuck, tonight. It's a pleasure to be here. I think that the thing that to sort of really think about is just how prevalent disabilities is in the workplace today. 1 in 5 people report having a disability, and you have a 20% chance of becoming disabled at some point during your working life. As it turns out, statistics from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the federal agency that receives complaints, investigates them, tries cases on behalf of workers, show that year after year, disability discrimination claims is the highest category of all claims behind retaliation. So It's outpaced sex, sexual harassment, sex discrimination, age, national origin, religion, race, color, all these other categories. Disability discrimination claims is the highest category. And also the amount of money, the monetary relief that's collected on behalf of workers has skyrocketed. You know, the year before last, it was $76 million, and last year it went over $100 million in
these are the awards that people have gotten.
This is not judgments. This is just the amount of money that the federal agency has collected on behalf of employees and settlements.
Oh my goodness!
So if you include judgments on top of that, it's astounding. Now on the state level, what we're seeing is, you know, the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing did the study over 10 years between 1997 and 2008, and they found that disability discrimination claims spiked 75% during that 10-year window, whereas claims in the other areas like sex, race, color, age, national origin actually declined. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing this huge spike in these kinds of claims. So it's clearly an issue that employers need to pay attention to. And when we talk about jury verdicts, that's also higher in the disability area, and sometimes double that of what, you know.
What's the basic mistake that employers have made then? If there's been this increase in disability discrimination, are they anticipating that employees who have disabilities just can't do the job, and so they want to get rid of these people? Is that what it is?
You know, I think, and Jean can certainly speak to this, but I think that a lot of what the litigation has been about is the failure to accommodate, to provide reasonable accommodations. I do want to add one little statistic, and I want to, you know, make sure Jean comes in on this, is that, you know, when we think about all these numbers, what's interesting is when you contrast that with the cost of accommodations, the cost of reasonable accommodations. Over half of the accommodations requested by applicants and employees didn't even cost a thing. Could have been something as simple as changing someone's work schedule or transferring them to a different position. And the average cost when accommodations were provided was only between $500 and $600. And three-quarters of all...
Those statistics are from where? Who has compiled those?
This is a study conducted by the University of Iowa's Law, Health, Policy, and Disability Center a number of years ago. And so, you know, when employers did provide accommodations, three-quarters of them reported that they were either very effective or extremely effective. So what I think is happening is the sort of lack of understanding of how to provide accommodations, what the employers are supposed to do when an employee has a medical condition or reveals that they have a disability in the workplace. There's a lot of lack of understanding.
Is it a lack of understanding because most employers, at least in the past, have not had the advice of employment lawyers to try to help them understand, hey, this is your obligation, you need to do this? Is that what it is, Jean, or what would you say from the standpoint of you're representing employees?
That is what I do. I represent exclusively employees and bring claims and lawsuits against employers when there is disability discrimination, including failure to accommodate. And there are two different types of disability discrimination that go on. One is the kind that you described at the outset. Employers just say, we don't want to have this person with disabilities here. We don't want to deal with it. We don't think this person, we just make an assumption based on stereotypes that this person's not going to be able to do the job, and then they either don't hire them or terminate them. But the more common, as Jane's been talking about, the more common type of claim that we see more and more has to do with reasonable accommodations. And employers need to understand the obligations that they have to provide accommodations, to do more than just treat everyone the same. When it comes to people with disabilities, the law requires you to treat them differently, which is a different way of understanding a civil rights law. And when it comes to people with disabilities, employers have an obligation to meet them more than halfway, to really understand what the needs are of the person with disabilities, look at the workplace, understand what the person can do, what their abilities are. And if there needs to be a bridge between the requirements of the job and the abilities of the person who's doing the job, the reasonable accommodation is that bridge.
What does reasonable accommodation really mean? Is there some relatively simple definition or not?
Absolutely. Yes. There are simple definitions and there are simple examples. A reasonable accommodation is a change to the way a job can be done. It's a modification of policies and procedures. It might be some sort of equipment that's provided to the employee. It is a restructuring, potentially, of the way a job is done or who does a job, maybe redistributing some of the functions to other people in the workplace if there's one particular function that a person with disabilities can't do. And a reasonable accommodation can include transferring someone to a different position if their disability has advanced to the degree that they can no longer perform the job they originally did, and an employer has another vacancy. The law requires them on a non-competitive basis to transfer that employee into that vacant position for which they're qualified so that the person with disabilities doesn't lose employment. It's an equal employment opportunity law.
How do you deal with the concept, generally speaking, that unless you have a written agreement with your employer, our employment is at will? Now, how does that deal with what you're talking about here?
It's true that California is an at-will state, and I'll let Jane address it from an employer's perspective as well, but employers have to abide by the civil rights laws, and that means you can make decisions as an employer based on your business, but if there is a place where you're going to make a decision that's based on someone's characteristics, their race, their gender, their disability, their sexual orientation, their religion, or a number of other protected characteristics, then you are not making a business decision. Mm-hmm. You're making a bias mm-hmm. decision, and okay. the law doesn't allow that. And the area of disability rights and reasonable accommodation says not only you can't discriminate, but you have to look individually to figure out what can you do to level the playing field for the person with disabilities so that they get a fair chance mm-hmm. to work, because mm-hmm. that's what it's about.
I think.
Well, pardon me, Jane, go ahead.
I think there's a misconception when it comes to the other areas like age and sex and race and national origin, employers think that if I treat everybody exactly the same, then I can't be liable for discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
In this area, as Jean alluded to, you have to treat people differently because of their disability. Mm-hmm. You might mm-hmm. have mm-hmm. to provide a reasonable accommodation. It kind of flips that notion of treating everybody the same on its head here. Here, the employer has an affirmative obligation to take certain steps to enable that person to perform the essential job functions if they're qualified for that particular position.
What if, and I want to take it away from the actual in the employment office situation where there may be the need for reasonable accommodation. What if you're applying for a job?
Same thing.
Same thing.
Same
law applies. Okay.
Absolutely. Right. So if somebody might need a sign language interpreter for mm-hmm. the job interview, mm-hmm. you might have to provide the job application in Braille. Mm-hmm. So the same rights extend to the from the interview through the hiring process, once they get hired, through training, promotion, and so forth. It extends throughout mm-hmm. the employment relationship.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I want to let you all know, those of you who are listening to the live program, we will take your calls during the second half hour of the program. I think all of you know that we are live in the Bay Area for a full hour. We're live on the internet at www.klw.org for a full hour. And by the way, I want to thank all of you who have been supportive of this station during the most recent fundraiser. I think the station got contributions from approximately 2,500 people, something like that, and had 580 new members, just a few thousand dollars short of the goal. And frankly, I feel that probably in the next few days or so, that goal will be reached. So I want to thank you very much for the support to this station. And I'm a great believer, as I've expressed this before, in keeping public radio non-commercial. I am a great believer in that, and that really counts on you continuing to support the station. So thank you very much. Let's do this. Before we go into some of the other issues that I know you want to talk about, and I want to give people a chance statewide to know what may be available to them on the web to educate themselves, you've given me some various websites, and if you don't mind, let me tick them off here. One is for the Employment Law Center in San Francisco, www.las-elc.org. That's the Employment Law Center Legal Aid Society, las-elc.org. And then if you would, Gene, there's something I have never heard about this before, www.askjan. Who in the world is Jan?
It's www.askjan.org.
Yeah.
And it's the Job Accommodation Network. This is a federally funded organization that provides free one-on-one consultation about job accommodation ideas for employees and for employers. Employees can call to request assistance with understanding what their rights are, with exploring what kinds of accommodations might help mm-hmm. for their particular disability and the kind of job that they do. The Job Accommodation Network has been around for years and years, and they have developed a clearinghouse of ideas mm-hmm. Based on clients who they've worked with, of particular accommodations that have helped. So they know about all of the software that may be out there, the equipment that may be out there, the accommodations that don't cost anything that can assist an employee who's trying to understand, what can I do on this job? And it's amazing if an employer and an employee really sit down And have a dialogue across the aisle in the same way that
you mean
Jane,
they can talk to each other.
We can, huh? And it's a wonderful thing. This is a very hopeful area of the law for me because it's really
good.
It's something that excuse me that it's an area of the law where that what's required is for people of goodwill to sit down and try to work something out together.
Well, that's the case, I think, in most areas of the law, though. You know, that people need to realize, hey, let's try to sit down and try to resolve this. There's another one, www.dfeh.ca.gov. Now, which one is that? That's the Department of Fair Housing and Employment, isn't it?
That's yes. Right. And that's where if someone has sort of reached the end of the line and feels as though they have not received accommodations or that they're being discriminated against or harassed or retaliated against in the workplace, they need to file a claim with the Department of Fair Employment and Housing within 1 year of the last incident of discrimination in order to preserve their right to bring a lawsuit. And the DFEH is empowered to investigate claims of discrimination, to try to remedy those claims of discrimination, and to bring charges before the Fair Employment and Housing Commission.
Does someone have to file a complaint with the DFEH first before that person decides, hey, I want to sue my employer?
Yes,
you
it
do.
Is a requirement.
Under
that
California law.
Under California law.
Right.
And if you're going to file a federal complaint, you need to file with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And the deadline there is only 300 days.
Really? And is that website, www.eeoc.gov?
Yes.
Is that the one for that? And then finally, there's a website that Jane has, www.hrlawconsultants.com. Now, what do you have on your website, Jane?
Well, what I have is a whole list of upcoming events and training programs for the employer community on this very important topic, including a conference in September, September 27th in San Francisco, where I'll be talking about how to investigate disability discrimination complaints that are filed by employees in the workplace. So it's constantly being updated, and I post information there as well.
So this is a lot of information for those of you who may feel that you want to try to educate yourself. You know, as I was reading the Jane's introduction about her background, I mentioned the term interactive process. Now, in all the years that I've been doing this program, I have never heard of that term. What is the interactive process?
The interactive process is a process that both employees and employers are required to participate in. And what it basically says is that at the point where an employer receives a request for accommodation from an employee, or the employer realizes that they've got a person with some sort of medical condition, a disability in the workplace who's having difficulty performing their job because of, or it may be because of their disability, then the employer is required to engage in an interactive process. It's a legal term of art, but it means really. The employer is supposed to talk to the employee to figure out what kind of accommodation might be possible to help the employee continue to perform the essential functions of their job. That's the bottom line, and Jane has more to say, it sounds like.
Well, if you, in California, if the employer fails to engage in the interactive process, it's a violation of the law. So you can't simply just provide the accommodation. This in and of itself is a requirement of the law. So it's so important that employers understand how to do this. And both sides have to talk because the employee may have most knowledge about what their capabilities are, what their limitations are, and the employer knows about the job and what the essential job functions are. So the two sides have to come together. And if I may, I've boiled it down to six easy steps. The six easy steps of the interactive process, I like to call it, for employers. It's because people get very intimidated by this. They don't know what to do. Somebody comes in and says, look, I have this condition. I need an accommodation. The employer gets very scared. What can I ask? What kind of information can I get? So the first step, I always encourage the employer to meet with the employee to identify what are their work limitations, work-related, what are their functional capabilities? What can and can't they do? And then secondly, analyze the essential job functions. Figure out what are the core functions of the position, because the accommodation need only enable the employee to perform the essential job functions. And then identify a range of possible accommodations, a menu of options, if you will. Then consider whether these options are reasonable and effective. Will they enable the employee to perform the essential job functions? Consider the employee's preference as step number 5, and implement the most reasonable and effective accommodation. And finally, follow up and make sure that the accommodation is effective and the employee doesn't suffer any negative consequences because they took some time off.
The problem that I see, if I may suggest this, is that I would think that a good percentage of employees would be very reluctant to be totally open about this. So what do you do to encourage the employee to really put it all on the table?
You know, I think it's important for employees to understand that when they are asking for some time off, that they don't go to the employer and say, I need some time off for personal reasons, because that may be unexcused.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if they say, you know, I need some time off because I have a doctor's appointment, or because I'm undergoing treatment for cancer, chemotherapy, or my medication is making me sicker, and I need some time off for that. Mm-hmm. Those can be treated as an accommodation if they're asking for that kind of time off. So employees need to understand that, you know, if they're asking for a specific type of accommodation, to be clear that it's driven by medical necessity.
You know, Chuck, I think this is an area where employees are in a tough spot and employers are in a tough spot. Employees are protective of their privacy, and rightly so. You never know, once somebody starts to find out about what's going on in your personal life, how that could have some sort of a negative effect. People are worried about disclosing personal information because they don't want the stereotyped assumptions that might follow. And so it's important to give enough information so that the employer understands that you're not just asking for something because you kind of want it, but because
you need it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes.
But you also don't need to go so far as to let the employer into your private medical records or give them the telephone number and the right to call your doctor. The employer doesn't have a right to delve that deeply, but they do have a right to know that you are a person with a disability. What the limitations are that you have because of the disability, and the fact that you need some accommodation in the workplace.
When I was promoting the program in the Bay Area, I made reference to the use of medical marijuana. Now, I know yesterday, a panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal came out, not in an employment case, but there are a couple of cities in Orange County that have ordinances to close down medical marijuana offices. And the Ninth Circuit, this panel, said, yeah, that's fine. So what is the obligation of the employer should an employee have a prescription by a doctor, a legitimate prescription by a doctor for the use of medical marijuana? What is the obligation of the employer to let that person use medical marijuana in the workplace?
Well, the law is...
If any obligation.
The law is really quite clear in California. The California Supreme Court has spoken on this issue in a case called Ross versus Raging Wire Telecommunications. And there, the court said that even if an employee is prescribed medicinal marijuana, let's say for back pain, which is what happened in this case, and then tests positive for drugs, the employer can terminate them.
Really?
So though California decriminalized medicinal marijuana, it's still a violation of federal drug statutes.
And the employers can follow that and not be sued for unlawful termination of employment.
Absolutely, yeah. So the case law is clear.
Let me then ask you.
Let me jump in and at least say that an employer is not required to terminate someone
for medical marijuana use.
Okay. That's right.
What about other medications that someone, other than, let's say, medical marijuana, Are there some restrictions, generally speaking, about an employee being able to, let's say, leave the work spot, whether it's the workstation or whatever, to go to the restroom or whatever and take a particular medication or whatever? Or is there some problem there or what?
No. In fact, that's the standard sort of accommodation. Frequently, you know, workplaces may have a no food at the workstation rule.
Yes.
But people with diabetes may need to keep something nearby in case they start to have a low blood sugar reaction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
An employer may have a strict break policy, but someone who lives with HIV may be on a medication regimen that requires them to go and take medication more regularly, and they need different breaks. That's exactly the kind of accommodation that may be needed, is a variation in the schedule, mm-hmm. some mm-hmm. kind of flexibility.
Now, Chuck, where this comes up a lot is where the medication might interfere with that person's ability to do their job. Let's say they're working on a production line.
Yes.
If they're working on an oil rig.
Oh, gosh.
In the emergency room.
Sure.
As a neonatal nurse. And, you know, would their somewhat impaired condition interfere with their ability to perform safely?
Yes.
Their essential job functions?
Yes.
Do they pose a threat of harm to themselves or others because of that?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I think some of the issues have come up in mm-hmm. the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you can't simply say that because a person is on medication that they are necessarily going to pose a direct threat. The employer still should identify specifically what symptoms, you know, what evidence they have where this person could pose a threat of substantial mm-hmm. You know, harm to themselves or others.
Sometimes employers are coming from a place of, I would call it, sort of paternalism. They think that they're being protective of the person with disabilities. If they talk to themselves, that's what they're going to say. They're going mm-hmm. to say, I'm looking out for this person, and I think, in my judgment, they shouldn't be doing this job because it's dangerous for them.
I see.
That is the beginning of discrimination.
Ah.
As
even though there's good faith. Good faith thinking and good faith moving on it.
What you're doing in that kind of a situation mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. you are robbing the person with disabilities of agency and of their own right to make decisions for themselves.
My gosh, wow. All right. Well, you know, we've come to the end of the statewide version of the program. And what I want to do is I want to invite you to call in, ask a question if you have a question about employment, your employment situation. Please feel free to call in. It's 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. If you're anywhere other than in the Bay Area and you're listening to us on the Internet at www.kalw.org, please join us on the same number, 1-415-841-4134. Let me tell you who my guests are, especially if you have joined us a little bit late in the program and you didn't hear me give the... I'm not going to give the long part of this, but let me tell you who we have here. Jean Hyams represents employees. She's a partner and trial lawyer in the Oakland law firm of Levy, Vinnick, Burrell, Hyams, where she represents employees in discrimination, harassment, retaliation, and whistleblower lawsuits. Jane Cow is the founder of HR Law Consultants, a San Francisco-based employment law firm that specializes in advising and training companies how to comply with a range of workplace laws, including their obligation to provide reasonable accommodations and leaves of absences. Jane does a lot of training throughout the state. Do you go beyond California, or is it just in California?
Absolutely. I just got back from Washington, D.C.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
So she does a lot of training to employers and employers groups, and so both of my guests are very experienced. So if you have a question, a comment, or whatever, please join us, 1-415-841-4134. And by the way, for those of you who don't have a clock, it's about 8. No, it's not 8. It's 7:29 at 91.7, your local public radio station. By the way, here's something that was brought into the studio, a question before we take our first listener on the line. What about a small business owner whose business is on the second floor and one of his employees has an accident and can't walk? Is the owner required to build an elevator and retrofit the restroom to accommodate the disabled employee? Now, this is a pretty extreme example. But what do you say to that, Jean?
Well, the standard that the law looks at in that sort of a situation is whether or not the accommodation is readily achievable, where you're looking at some sort of a change to the workplace that's architectural to that degree, and whether it would impose an undue hardship on the employer.
It sounds to me to have to build an elevator, it would.
Well, it depends on who the employer is, I suppose.
Okay.
If it's a multinational corporation, an elevator is a drop in the bucket.
As opposed to a grocery store owner. Yeah, yeah. Small business owner.
Right.
Okay, any comments on that?
Well, it might be unduly costly for a grocery store owner to have to build an escalator, for example. So
okay, all right. So you have to use some common sense and what is a reasonable accommodation. That's kind of the key phrase, certainly, in there. All right.
But in that circumstance,
yeah,
if I could,
yeah,
one
please.
Should look at whether or not it's possible for the person to work on the first floor instead.
Good point.
I mean, there
Good
are
point.
Lots of, yeah. of different ways to approach a situation, and yeah. so it's not a cut-and-dried answer. You have to sit down and be creative and try to understand, is there some way for this person to continue to be able to perform their job without it imposing an undue hardship on the employer? And that standard of undue hardship is extremely difficult for an employer to prove, maybe in this kind of circumstance, which is quite extreme, could.
This is an extreme example, no question. All right. Jeff, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I've been off work on disability for several years. So my question is, how do I explain that gap in my employment history and without, like, it, you know, them just, like, turning me down right away? And how would I be able to prove even that they did turn me down because I've been disabled?
How long were you disabled, Jeff?
About 5 years.
And are you okay now?
Yeah, but I don't want the disability company to know that because they think that once you're ready to go back to work, they don't have to pay anymore. So it's a weird quandary to be in.
You know, a lot of times disability companies actually have programs where they will let you return to work and continue to draw the private disability. I assume this is some kind of private disability insurance.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They'll let you continue to draw the private disability insurance while you're trying to return to work. A lot of good disability carriers, and there are some out there, will even assist you in trying to become rehabilitated to go back to work. So I would be sure to investigate carefully to see whether or not your assumption that they're not going to be happy that you're ready to try is correct. You're in a tough position. You have no obligation to disclose the fact that you were a person with disabilities or that you are a person with disabilities and that accounts for the time gap in your resume. But obviously, you need to come up with an explanation. And you should never lie either.
No.
Maybe at this point in time with the economy the way that it's been, you will run into the assumption that what you've experienced is difficulty finding work because of the economy. And perhaps the thing to do is to let that assumption play itself out.
Mm-hmm. Who should, in terms, I mean, this is a significant issue that Jeff is confronted with, very, very important. At this point, being not an employment law attorney, which I am not, but a consumer advocate in my job as a deputy DA for San Mateo County, who might he seek out? I mean, you were talking about disability companies who can help him. Some you mentioned are good and can be very helpful. Who else might he seek out to try to get some advice about how to deal with this so that he doesn't feel so intimidated about trying to go out and trying to get some work?
Yeah, because nowadays, you know, a lot of people want you to post your resume online, and I'm really afraid to do that, that will be like a red flag to the disability company to cut me off, and I'm just not sure.
I'm very wary of anyone putting their resume online because there's so much scamming going on. But in any event, do you have any comments for Jane for Jeff on this?
Well, you know, I can certainly speak to the employer community, right? Or speak, you know, if say Jeff came in for a job interview, and he you know, if he disclosed, the focus shouldn't be on his condition or his disability, but can he do the job?
Yeah.
And what are his relevant skills, experience, et cetera, qualifications for the position? And if he still is, you know, is still disabled, you know, does he need any form of assistance or accommodation in order to perform his essential job functions? So don't fall into the trap of asking him some impermissible questions about his condition or diagnosis or medication, but ask Jeff, you know, what, let's talk about the job and let's talk about your qualifications and experience. So that's the advice I would have for the employers.
Okay. And
does that help you, Jeff?
Yeah, it does. Thank you very
much. Okay. Hey, good luck to you. Thank you very much for calling. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing a program on integrating employees with disabilities and medical conditions into the workforce. So join us if you have a question, comment, et cetera. If you have a question or comment that goes beyond disabilities, certainly feel comfortable to bring it up in the employment law area. The number is 1-415-841-4134. And Alex, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi.
I've been disabled for about, legally disabled for about 6 years now, and was disabled for quite a bit before that. But anyway, this union that I belonged to for many years, example, you'd need 6 credits, and 6 credits being duration of time, in order to go ahead and get your pension when you became of age. Well, if you become disabled, the way it was, is that if you only needed 5 credits. If you became disabled during that time and you had 5 credits, well, then you get full pension benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I put in for the paperwork and everything when I found out about it. So then, meanwhile, I had all my paperwork, everything together, and my car was stolen and was told with all my information.
Oh, my.
And it was tough to find out even where the union was. Anyway, when I finally got back a hold of them, they put up all these, it seemed like, just roadblocks. And then I told them my situation, and they said, well, no, you need 6 credits.
Oh,
and I said, well, you know, no, just a while back, you know, when I called and I talked to you folks, you said it was only, well, she said it was only 5. We changed it. We now made it 6.
Mm-hmm.
So is that legal?
How recent was it that you learned that it's now 6?
That was about 2 years ago.
2 years ago. So you don't have a pension then at this point, right?
Right. They said I'm not eligible, but at one point I was, only about... 3 years ago, I was eligible.
Yeah. What comments? What general? But by the way, please understand this, Alex. My guests are very experienced, very knowledgeable, very competent employment law attorneys, but they are not permitted to give specific legal advice. The state bar does not permit it. But hopefully, they'll give you some direction that may be some help to you. What thoughts do you have, Gene, for Alex in this type of situation where he was eligible for this? He had this crazy thing where his car was stolen and all of his information was stolen, and then the union changed its requirements, and now he's not eligible. What comments do you have for him?
This is really an area that's outside of the area that I practice.
Right.
It's probably an area where you want to talk to someone who's an ERISA lawyer. ERISA, which is the act that covers retirement plans and programs.
Right.
That's a very specialized area of law, and you'd want to look for someone who has that particular specialty.
Where are you located, Alex?
I'm in Hayward.
Yeah, there should be no problem for your finding an ERISA lawyer, frankly. I mean, San Francisco, I'm sure, has plenty. Alameda County has plenty. I think what you need to do probably is, since you are in Hayward, what might make sense is for you to call the Alameda County Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service, see if they have anybody, or certainly call the San Francisco Lawyer Referral Service, and I'll give you some more information about that. You have not, I take it, met with a lawyer to find out what you can or cannot do. Is that right?
No, I haven't.
Okay. You need to, you know? I try to light a Bunsen burner under people because I do believe it's very important that people become active, proactive in terms of their own legal rights, because nobody else is going to do it for you. And in the lawyer referral type of service, you can get some pretty good initial information that may be very helpful and give you a roadmap of where to go. So I'm going to give a phone number in just a minute. Do you have something to write?
I have it right in my hand.
Okay, if you'll turn your radio back up, I'm going to give this information, and hopefully it may be of some help to you and others.
And okay. Give me the initials again, the ER blah, 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 okay, please?
You mean ERISA?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, ERISA.
ISA, very
yeah.
good.
ERISA, ERISA, yeah.
Hey, but, bless you guys. Thank you very
yeah.
much.
Yeah, Alex, thanks for calling. And our number again, 1-415-841-4134 if you have a question in the employment law area. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KALW listeners like you. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own at 650-369-4149. 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone competent and experienced and set you up for a half an hour consultation. Depending on the county, for a half an hour, it could be a low of $25, maybe a high of $35. And so it's a great way to start. And I wish you, Alex, some good luck with this. But at this point, you really need to do this. So, all right, those of you out there, I don't know what's going on, but hey, it's time. If you have an employment law question, don't wait until the last few minutes. It's 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134 if you'd like to call in. Jane.
Well, one of the things that we haven't yet talked about is some of the new laws protecting employees' rights to medical privacy.
Yes.
And specifically, there's the Federal Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, known as GINA, which went into effect in January of 2011, and California's version went into effect January of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what has created sort of what I call an invisible electric fence around inquiries related to someone's condition. So employers really need to be aware of this, because if an employee comes into work and says, you know, I just got diagnosed with this rare form of cancer, and the employer, out of compassion, says, oh my goodness, That runs in my family,
mm-hmm.
and my
mm-hmm.
you know, I had my kids were tested, my parents, my siblings. How about you?
Mm.
They've just made an impermissible inquiry into whether or not the employee has a genetic predisposition to a disease, disorder, or condition,
mm-hmm.
and that's a violation of these laws.
I see.
So, you know, this is where no good deed goes unpunished here,
mm-hmm,
where the
mm-hmm.
employer may be acting out of compassion,
mm-hmm.
but they can't ask those questions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a line that's been very clearly drawn by these new laws.
If an employer does that, which is a violation of the law, what do you recommend as to how an prospective employee or an employee should respond in terms of not, let's say, angering the employer?
Well, that's always the position that the employee is put in a situation where there's some
yeah.
sort of intrusive question,
yeah.
however well-intentioned it might be. And I think that employees simply should hold the line and say, you know, that's private.
Mm-hmm.
That's private information. I don't feel comfortable talking about this.
Yeah.
Employees can volunteer information, but employers should really resist the impulse
yes.
to intrude.
Yes.
I always tell employers, stick with the job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What are the essential functions?
Yeah.
What are the person's work-related limitations? What are their functional capabilities? That way you can't get into trouble by asking these questions about, you know, what is your diagnosis? You know, do you have a genetic predisposition to this disease? Those are
mm-hmm.
impermissible questions.
Okay.
But
right.
stick with the job.
Where can you find these new laws that you've just told us about, the federal and the state? Are they on any website that someone can take a look at?
Sure. I don't have the citations here off the top of my head.
Well, while you're looking for that, let me pose this question. This one was just brought into the studio. What is the penalty if an employer asks impermissible questions about medical conditions? What can the employee get out of this?
Well, interestingly, particularly where employers have a practice of doing so, there can be and there have been some pretty significant class action lawsuits mm-hmm. brought mm-hmm. against employers where, for instance, they ask about genetic information of all of their employees, or they give psychiatric or psychological tests to incoming employees.
Which is impermissible?
Which is impermissible. Sure. Even some of the personality tests that employers like to give impermissible because they have a psychological or psychiatric components to them. And that's, you know, it's not permissible for an mm-hmm. employer to try to figure out whether you have some sort of a psychological condition on mm-hmm. your way in mm-hmm. in the door and to mm-hmm. screen people out mm-hmm. on that basis. And mm-hmm. so it's a very problematic practice.
If it's not a class action lawsuit, and let's say it's an individual situation, what are the possible sanctions that a court may award?
Well, certainly if an employee is not hired because they were screened out because of these types of questions, then they have a claim for failure to hire. And the types of damages that you can recover in that sort of a lawsuit are the wages that you would have earned had you been given the job, and the emotional distress that you've suffered, kind of the human cost of being denied a job for that sort of a reason.
So the potential damages can be significant.
Significant, very significant.
Do you have any comments about that, Jean?
Well, you know, it's interesting because these are brand new laws. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in the first full year since its enactment, last year, 245 charges under this Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act were filed with the EEOC. And so far, none of these charges have proceeded yet to litigation.
Really?
So
that's nationally?
Yes.
That's nationally.
So we don't have any good case law yet. But the claims were mm-hmm. filed as soon as the act went mm-hmm. into effect. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I have a citation now for you, and it's 29... CFR section 1635 are the regulations.
Oh, really? 29 CFR. That's California.
Section.
What does CFR stand?
Code of Federal Regulations.
Code of Federal Regulations, okay.
Section 1635.
Okay.
Those are the regulations that explain the law.
All right. In case you're interested. All right, Fred, welcome to your legal rights.
Yeah, I have a question in terms of the reasonableness of the accommodations that the mm-hmm. employer needs to make for employees to have, a disability who've made a request. And then also about voluntary disclosures where you've casually disclosed a lot of information to coworkers or lateral supervisors and the like. Mm. What are some of the, you know, good practices from an employee's point of view? But the main question is what sorts of processes are supposed to be undertaken in order to figure out what the reasonable accommodation is in light of the situation?
Do you have any specific situation in mind?
Well, in this case, it would be, if there's a request for a certain kind of work schedule for flexible work times, working from remote locations to accomplish the work, to accommodate a disability, where, you know, it's pretty typical in terms of kinds of things that employers do, and that the employer has extended, you know, what kind of obligation do they have to be reasonable? I mean, can they make you jump through 23 hoops, or how much, you know, can they really make an employee do?
It sounds like you're saying that the employer already has a practice of telecommuting. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. So, if they already have some kind of plan that's in place and the employee is requesting telecommuting consistent with its policies and procedures, or they're asking for something above and beyond that?
Well, they're actually reducing the options for telecommuting.
Oh, I see. And you're saying that you might need this because of a disability accommodation. Is that your question?
Yeah, if you've already been using it, a policy that's being eliminated. Mm. Now they're eliminating a policy across the board.
And what are they what are they saying why they are doing that, Fred? Do they give an explanation?
Just sort of a general tightening of...
Tightening? They're trying to save money? That's the basic reason for this?
I can't really say. They didn't disclose any motivations, but they... And I'm not sure, actually, whether it's a general policy or they've just decided to enforce it selectively because I don't have enough information, whether this is true, that they've really, they haven't changed the personnel policy, but they may have changed the practice because they're denying requests for telecommuting.
Well, Fred, you know, if you need any form of accommodation, whether it's telecommuting or a schedule or, you know, a transfer to a different position or what have you, the employer has a right to request medical documentation in support right. of your request for an accommodation.
Right.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, they don't have a right to inquire into any kind of genetic predisposition into your disease or disorder or any kind of impairment, but it's sufficient to enable them to determine that this is medically driven, that there is a medical basis for your need to telecommute.
They've moved into a more formal realm, so that even though that was sort of established as an informal conversational thing, now they want to do, you know, all of the various requisite paperwork, which, you know, sounds like on the face of it, maybe they're just tightening up the ship and they want to make sure all their paperwork is good, but maybe they also want to make it harder for people to get through.
Well, what they could be doing is documenting that they're doing the interactive process because they're required to do that by law.
So they have to provide a paper trail of having...
Well, they want to be able to show that, you know, that they have... engaged in an interactive dialogue with you in good faith to determine, you know, what your limitations are, what your capabilities are, what the essential job functions are, and what possible accommodations would enable you to perform your job. And, you know, is this the only option? I mean, if there's paperwork involved, often the employer is doing that because they want to be able to document that they complied with the law.
You know, Fred, you're giving me an opportunity to run through sort of my five big tips to people who have disabilities who are seeking accommodations in the workplace. And the first one is to know your rights. So calling into this show is a good first step. And there are all those resources that Chuck has listed and some more that we can give you. It's also really important that you document your request for accommodations. It's not legally required for an employee to document their request for accommodations, but it's extremely...
By that, you mean put it in writing.
I mean put it in writing. Mm-hmm. You can have a verbal conversation, but send a follow-up email.
Sure. Yeah.
Whenever you have a communication that's about asserting your rights, whether it's requesting accommodations or objecting to sexual harassment in the workplace or whatever, it's very important that employees document what they're doing by communicating directly to the employer. So you want to make a clear statement that you're requesting accommodations for a disability. If you've been just going along previously with the regular telecommuting policy, the employer may or may not have realized that you were using it as an accommodation, and now you're asking for something that is an accommodation. You want to be clear about that, and you need to provide the information about what your limitations are. You need to explain why the telecommuting is an important accommodation that you need, to, you know, sort of offer a willingness to provide more information if the employer doesn't feel like they've gotten enough. And that can include providing some sort of doctor's supporting documentation. And then you need to wait and see if they respond. The interactive process, the way that that works is that the employer and the employee both have an obligation to engage in a prompt and good faith process. And that's there's two pieces to that.
Yeah. Well, what I did was I submitted a letter from my practitioner, and then they asked for a generalized medical release form.
Well, that's one of my other tips, is you should protect your privacy. The employer does not have a right to a generalized medical release to speak to your practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
You instead should go back to them, and this is what the EEOC guidance says, that what you should do is to go back to the employer and say, I'm more than happy to give you more information. Please tell me what your questions are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the ball should be in their court to explain why they need more information.
They should disclose the questions to me, not just...
That's right. I tell my clients that you should be a part of every communication with your healthcare practitioners and your employer. Don't let them speak directly to each other.
Speak when you're not there. Okay.
That cuts to the heart of it. Thank you very much.
Okay, Fred. Let me also repeat the various websites that I think are very important for people to know about in terms of educating yourselves. For the Legal Aid Society in San Francisco, the Employment Law Center, www.las-elc.org. And then there's the national website, www.askjan.org. There's www.dfeh.ca.gov. There's www.eeoc.gov. And then my guest, Jane Cow, has her website, which has a lot of information on it, www.hrlawconsultants.com. So those various websites, if you have lots of questions or some questions, are probably going to be very beneficial to you. And I know that the Employment Law Center in San Francisco has other handouts that are available. If you go to their website, you'll find some very valuable stuff that may be helpful to you. All right, let's see if we can take another. I guess we're nearly out of time, but let me see if we can take another call here. Dean, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Dean, are you there?
All right, thank you.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay,
go ahead.
Right, thank you. I'm sorry, this isn't all into the medical issues, but I just started a new job. I work for a vendor full-time in a hotel, and today the hotel said that men cannot wear earrings, and I have an earring, and my coworker also has an earring, and I just wondered if that was a discrimination issue or if that's viable or if that's legal for them to say.
How long have you been employed by this place?
This is my first full week.
First full week, and you wear an earring, and now you understand you can't wear an earring. Okay, well, what comments? And is this in San Francisco?
It's in South San Francisco.
South San Francisco, not as liberal as San Francisco by any means. But what comments do you have, if any, Gene, on this?
Without knowing sort of more about the workplace, it's hard, you know, employers are entitled to have some sort of dress codes. It sort of depends on.
Okay.
Yes, and they can have different ones for men and women.
I wouldn't bucket.
They can or they cannot?
Can.
They can. C-A-N. Oh, okay. Don't bucket, Dean.
Although
jobs are too few at this point.
And I will take the earring out. All right. Thank you for taking my call.
Hey,
thanks very much. And it's a great show. I really appreciate it. I listen to it a lot.
Well, thank you very much. And good luck to you. All right. I think, let me see. Do we have, I guess we don't have, unfortunately, essentially, we have actually run out of time. I want to thank you both very much for joining me. It's been a pleasure having you both on the program.
Thank you, Chuck.
I'm not going to read all of their information again, but because it's too comprehensive. But my guests have been both employment law attorneys, Jane Cow, who represents employers, HR law consultants in San Francisco, and Gene Hyams, who represents employees, partner in the Oakland law firm of Levy, Vinnick, Burrell, and Hyams. I thank you both for joining me. It's been very nice. And, Gene has a website also, www.levyvinick.com. All right, so you've been a website, I won't say to death, but you got a number that may be very helpful. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Next week, we're going to be talking about bullying and school violence prevention. My guests will be San Mateo County Deputy District Attorney James Wade, who I've worked with for many years, Certified Specialist in Criminal Law Jeff Hayden and Garrett Rutgers, and Rick Phillips, Executive Director of Community Matters, a nonprofit organization promoting violence prevention in schools. I hope you join me then. Thank you very much for joining us. And again, thank you all for supporting this station, KALW Public Radio. I'm Chuck Feeney.